This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. How food lovers, free spirits, misfits, and wanderers created a new American profession. By Andrew Friedman. Read by Roger Wayne. Gastronomy and cooking for me have always been about being a link in a chain, taking from the past, making my contribution, working hard on creating a legacy. I've had a lot of people show me a lot of different things to make me who I am, and I try to do that to my younger cooks. They're going to be much better cooks than I am. That's just how it works. You get better and better just being a link in the chain. In a culinary endeavor, where the traditions are so rich, it benefits you to know what happened before you, to study it and learn about it, to read about it and be fascinated by it. You have to understand who these people are so you can move forward. David Kinch. Staff meeting. Okay, gather around, everybody. Just a few things before we open the doors. This first note is for the kitchen. What follows is intended as a narrative, impressionistic summary of the transformation of professional cooking in the United States during the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s. While many prominent chefs from the era are profiled, this book by no means constitutes a comprehensive survey of everybody who contributed to the industry over the 20-plus years it covers. In our interview, Patrick O'Connell, chef proprietor since 1978 of the landmark hotel and restaurant The Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia, made a helpful point. We all have so many parallels. We had a party at Per Se for the great French chef Paul Bocuse. It was about 30 American chefs that Thomas Keller had invited, and everybody was asked to stand for a moment and tell their story. And it usually involved some inspirational intersection with Bocuse and the great Michelin-starred restaurants of that era when we had nothing comparable yet in America. You would listen to their stories, and except for your own idiosyncrasy and personality, it was, oh my God. You had no idea we were all on the same trip, and didn't even know each other. With those parallels in mind, I have focused primarily on the broad historical strokes, and on the central hubs where the most chefs were concentrated. The Bay Area, Los Angeles, and New York City, and on game changers rather than those generally acknowledged to have been cooking the best or most influential food, although they are often the same. The example of Le Cote Basque says a lot. Readers who were around in the 1970s and 80s will be surprised, if not scandalized, that Jean-Jacques Rochou casts a longer shadow here than André Soultner, but New York City cooks who were there will understand. And that decision should make sense to one and all by the time the dust clears. With all of this in mind, many godlike talents, including some who took precious time to treat me to deeply revealing interviews, are scarcely mentioned, if at all. And related developments, such as the contemporaneous expansion of the American wine industry, have been necessarily relegated to the sidelines and footnotes. Logic aside, please know that making these decisions caused me great personal anguish and was responsible for at least one lapse deadline. And please accept my sincere apology if I failed to find the right spot to pay respect to you or your mentor. For the dining room. In the interest of full disclosure, you should know that I have collaborated on books with many of the chefs in this story, though I have avoided it while working on this project, and count many more as friends and acquaintances. And so, while I was fortunate to gain access to the breadth of people interviewed, I'm also inclined toward discretion. All of which is to say that this book, despite its title, isn't by any means a tell-all, and that certain people known industry-wide for a range of illicit behaviors and weaknesses don't show any powder on their noses here, either because they wouldn't cop to it themselves or denied it on the record. My wish was to write a strictly oral history, with the story told exclusively in the voices of the participants. But too many memories proved incomplete or flawed. So I consulted a mountain of books and periodicals, and did more writing than originally planned, although the story is still largely carried by the words captured in a few hundred interviews. Quotations from those interviews are cast in the present tense, he says, whether living or deceased, while those from third-party sources are in the past tense, she said. With everybody's best interest at heart, and with the consent of the participants, I have performed some minor editing on some quotations from my interviews to eliminate false starts, confusing colloquialisms, and the like. In no cases have my adjustments altered the speaker's meaning. Okay. Thank you. Let's have a good service. Andrew Friedman. Introduction. Prep work. We all had the same acid flashback at the same time. Jonathan Waxman. You could begin this story in any number of places. So why not in the back of a dinged-up VW van parked on a Moroccan camping beach, a commune of tents and makeshift domiciles? It's Christmas, 1972. Inside the van is Bruce Martyr, an American college dropout. He's a Los Angelino, a hippie, and he looks the part. Vagabonding for 6 months has left him scrawny and dead broke. His jeans are stitched together, hanging on for dear life. Oh, and this being Christmas, somebody has gifted him some LSD, and he's tripping. The van belongs to a couple, French woman, Dutch man, who have taken him in. It boasts a curious feature, a built-in kitchen. It's not much, just a set of burners and a drawer, stocked with mustard and cornichons. But they make magic there. The couple has adventured as far as India, amassing recipes instead of Polaroids, sharing memories with new friends through food. To Mortar, raised in the Eisenhower era on processed industrialized grub, each dish is a revelation. When the lid comes off a tagine, he inhales the steam, redolent of an exotic and unfamiliar herb, cilantro. The same with curry, also unknown to him before the van. Like a lot of his contemporaries, Mortar fled the United States. "People wanted to get away," he says, "away from the Vietnam War, away from home and the divorce epidemic. The greater world beckoned, the kaleidoscopic tambourine-backed utopia promised by invading British rockers and spiritual sideshows like the Maharishi. The price of admission was cheap. For a few $100 on a no-frills carrier such as Icelandic Airlines, nicknamed a hippie airline and hippie express, you could be strolling Piccadilly Circus or the Champs-Élysées, your life stuffed into a backpack, your Eurail pass a ticket to ride. Martyr flew to London alone, with $800 and a leather jacket to his name, and improvised, crashing in parks and on any friendly sofa and, if he couldn't score any of that, splurging on a hostel. He let himself go, smoking ungodly amounts of pot, growing his hair out to shoulder length. In crowds, he sensed kindred spirits, young creatures of the road, mostly from Spain and Finland. Few Americans. Food, unexpectedly, dominated life overseas. Delicious, simple food that awakened his senses and imagination. Amsterdam brought him his first French fries with mayonnaise. An epiphany. The souks, markets of Marrakesh, with their food stalls and communal seating, haunt him. Within 5 months, he landed on that camping beach in Agadir, still a wasteland after an earthquake 12 years prior. He lived on his wits. Back home, he'd become fluent in hippie cuisine. Now he spent his last pennies on brown rice and vegetables, cooking them for strangers who shuttled him around. Just in time, people started feeding him, like the couple in whose van he was nesting. Food was as much a part of life on the beach as volleyball and marijuana. People cooked for each other, spinning the yarns behind the meals, where they'd picked them up and what they meant in their native habitats. Some campers developed specializations, like the tent that baked cakes over an open burner. Often, meals were improvised. You'd go to town, buy a pail, fill it with a chicken, maybe some yogurt or some vegetables and spices, and figure out what to do with it when you got back. Martyr might as well have been on another planet. "This was so un-American at that time," he says. He was supposed to become a dentist, but his heart was never in it. It was just one of those non-dreams foisted on him and his friends by tradition-bound elders. Back in L.A., he'd been a stoner, but a motivated one, laying the groundwork for independence. Caddying, pumping gas, anything for a buck. And so he was primed for a course correction when he dropped acid that Christmas, and a new, previously unimaginable path materialized. "I'm sitting in the back of the van and I'm whacked out," Martyr says. "I'm always thinking about my life. What am I going to do? Obviously, I'm not going to be a dentist. I can't go back to school and take organic chemistry. I just sit up and go, 'God, I know what I want to do. This is what I want to do. I want to learn. I want to be a chef.'" I met Bruce Martyr as I met many of the chefs and industry veterans interviewed for this book, in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. So it's hard to fathom how young they were, scarcely in their 20s, when they began shaping the professional cooking trade in the United States. Now they are gray, their edges sanded, their stories perfected through years of retelling. But once upon a time, even the most iconic of the lot were impulsive, sometimes irresponsible, occasionally self-destructive, just living their lives. Martyr isn't famous, but he's been successfully operating as a chef owner for 4 decades. His clubby Santa Monica Italian charmer, Capo, commands one of the highest check averages in the greater Los Angeles area. He's also a partner and guiding culinary light in a handful of other restaurants and Red Rooster Bakery, where he honors a late career fascination with bread making. At his West Beach Cafe, which he opened in 1978 in a barren bunker of a space a half block from the sands and surf of Venice Beach, Martyr was churning out template-shattering food before many of his contemporaries who have attained legend status. Yet he remains relatively anonymous. His improvisational eclecticism, juxtaposing American, French, and Italian influences in dishes such as oysters topped with California caviar, porcini risotto with fresh thyme, basil linguine with morels and walnut oil, duck breast tacos, and stuffed calamari and steak with fries, made stodgy French restaurants, the only serious game in town in those days, look instantly stale. Wolfgang Puck protégé Kazuto Matsusaka says that many chefs used to eat at West Beach Cafe for the express purpose of pilfering Martyr's ideas. Jeremiah Tower, one of the titans of his generation of chefs and no slouch in the influence department himself, considers Martyr an underappreciated visionary and frequently cites the restaurant as transformative. In his youth, Martyr was attractive and confident enough for celebrity. 2 female contemporaries confessed they had crushes on him once upon a time, and former New West Magazine and Los Angeles Times writer Ruth Reichel described him in print as possibly the most handsome chef in Tinseltown. And yet, Martyr has never been especially well-known, or even popular among his peers, many of whom just plain don't like him. Why is not a mystery. He's antisocial, even to customers. He doesn't cavort with fellow chefs, doesn't make the charity rounds, doesn't play the PR game, doesn't give a hang what anybody thinks. For all his influence, he's never been nominated for Chefdom's Oscar, a James Beard Foundation award.
"I just think he's not a self-promoter," says Reichel. "He just isn't. He's missing that ego piece. If I were him, it would drive me crazy. He kick-started this before anyone. West Beach Cafe was a game-changer in L.A. You want to talk about California cuisine? Nobody was serving it before him. Nobody. That casual, grilled, pared-down, unadorned, looking to California as opposed to France or Italy food. And that laid-back space. Look at what he did."
Martyr shrugs. "The image I have in my mind is of the guy who was the owner of Paris's Taiwan, the late Jean-Claude Brunat. I met him in Burgundy at a winery. He wanted to be in his restaurant and he wanted to take care of his customers. That's who I am. All these stars, you go to their restaurant and they're not in their restaurant. I don't feel that anybody's as passionate about what I do as I am." Martyr is given to frank pronouncements, and not just about his colleagues. He met the woman who would become his first wife at the wedding of a mutual friend. When he asked her out, She protested that she was married. He didn't mince words.
You're not happily married, and you know it.
My first meeting with this notorious figure was at the bar at Capo in October 2013. Based on reputation, I feared a hostile witness. I needn't have worried. When I thanked him for making time, he disarmed and amused me by deadpanning,
"Well, I just thought this might be more fun than less."
After the interview, we spent hours sipping wines, sampling pastas, splitting a sublimely charred steak from a wood-burning fireplace behind the far end of the bar. To my surprise, I liked Martyr, in part because his professed passion was manifest. He forensically detailed the selections in Capo's breadbasket and recounted how he'd picked up his method of saucing pasta at the Pescatore in Florence. I also admired his attention to front-of-house matters. Late in the evening, he pointed to the paintings around the dining room, explaining how a master decorator once taught him the trick to illuminating artwork, letting the light itself show without too much, if any, emphasis on its source. We were joined for that interview by his girlfriend, now wife, Shelley Kellogg, a resolutely sunny soul. She was also with him in New York City more than a year later to attend Martyr's daughter Olivia's New York University graduation. We conducted a follow-up interview over breakfast at the West Village restaurant Buvette that week, during which I broached the subject of his personality, or lack thereof.
"If I can be blunt, you're not known as the most gregarious person," I said.
"Well, that's true," he rumbled. He likes the portrait of him Coleman Andrews, prolific author and one-time editor of New West Magazine, offers in his memoir, My Usual Table. What I was like at West Beach Cafe. First, you thought he was a jerk, and then, when you get to know him, he's really quite funny. I think that's pretty accurate. When I interview Andrews, who considers Martyr a friend, he tells me that jerk was actually, if such a thing is possible, a euphemism for asshole. Chef history, like any history, is told by the victors. And so this book begins with Martyr to keep us, author and reader, honest. To add a grain of salt, a reminder of the role of promotion and politics in the allocation of credit. Martyr has a seat at this table, but others who mattered are surely absent, swallowed up by the sea of time, whether through modesty, mortality, geography, or quirks of personality. I also begin with Martyr because, let's face it, you can't beat that van story, and also for a passing moment that occurred between us at Capo. He was deep into recounting the West Beach Cafe, the two of us leaning close over a votive, a little buzzed on red wine. Restaurants, at some level, are homes, imbued with life by their occupants, and spiritually transformed by those who succeed them. West Beach Cafe shuttered in 1996, but the space, just 2 miles down the coastline from Capo, now houses another restaurant, James Beach. That seems somehow impossible as Martyr evokes another time and place, another world, really, of the canvases by Venice painters that hung on the walls, the art world clientele, the notorious after-service cocaine parties. At some point around midnight every evening, he told me, it was, "Katie, bar the door." Both of Martyr's adult sons, dressed in preppy ensembles, were working the dining room at Capo that night, and they periodically stopped by the bar to listen and chuckle along with the bartender at their old man's sex and drug-laced recollections. Some might find this appalling. To me, it was touching.
"West Beach was the bomb," Martyr growled,
sotto voce, at the climax of the tale, lost in a reverie, a little disbelieving of his own success.
"It was the bomb. It was the bomb. It was the bomb. I walked in there every night, and it was the bomb."
I can still hear Martyr's world-weary voice, see his wonder-struck eyes and craggy, bestubbled face, flecked with candlelight, as he repeated that phrase. It reminded me of the last moments of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, released in 1982, smack dab in the midst of West Beach's heyday.
"I've seen things you people wouldn't believe," says replicant ringleader Roy Batty,
as he sits dying before Rick Deckard, recounting the cosmic astonishments he's witnessed. "All those moments will be lost in time," he muses, "like tears in rain." Marder and his contemporaries, the chefs in this book, saw things we people wouldn't believe. They took a centuries-old profession with no real American strain and made it their own. There's a time-worn argument over whether cooking should be considered an art or a craft. Lost in the crossfire is that it's more ephemeral than either. Many of these chefs fret that they and their contemporaries have been forgotten, when an eye blink ago they were household names. I share their disappointment. But impermanence comes with the territory. Any chef will tell you that they have to prove themselves, from scratch, every day. By the same token, the dishes they cook don't hang in a museum, can't be ordered from Amazon, won't pleasantly surprise you when you happen upon them on HBO. Meals pass through us. Restaurants close. Chefs, like General MacArthur's old soldiers, just fade away. Save for menus, cookbooks, and more recently, documentaries, there's no element of cooking that won't inevitably be lost to the ages, including those who savored it. Gone forever. Like tears in rain. You only have to go back to the early 60s, into basically the generation that sought to overthrow the government, in a sense, the anti-war movement, that bunch of us who objected to the way our parents' generation was thinking. It has to do with art. It has to do with revolution, the Andy Warhol revolution, if you will. It has to do with the novel, with perhaps In Cold Blood, the first novel to create the genre of the non-fiction novel. It probably has to do with the overthrow of music by the Beatles and Elvis. There's no creative effort, I would think, that was not questioned by my generation. I'm a post-World War II baby. That generation that stood up against the Vietnam War, that welcomed the Beatles and Elvis, that even sanctioned non-representative painting. All of those aesthetics were questioned over a period of a decade, perhaps. And not just questioned, but they were kind of overthrown. So, why not food, too? Because food suffered, in a sense, by not being thought of as an aesthetic endeavor, a creative endeavor, or a personal endeavor, as movies were not. All of these things were thought to be the bailiwick of the privileged few who laid down the rules and said how things were to taste, look, sound, and read. And that all kind of happened at that time. And food was just maybe the caboose of that train. Tony Bill, filmmaker and restaurateur. This is the story of the dawn and rise of the American chef, which for our purposes commenced when Americans, from coast to coast and in large numbers, began voluntarily, enthusiastically cooking in restaurants for a living, a once forbidden and unrespected professional course. Screw the consequences. Many started like Martyr, spontaneously, rebelliously, often in isolation, with no idea that there were others like them out there. A few stuck their toes in the water in the 1960s. A few more in the 1970s, and then hordes jumped into the pool in the 1980s and 90s, after which there was no looking back. These weren't the first American chefs, or even the first prominent ones. There had always been exceptions, like the astounding Edna Lewis, who for 5 years ending in 1954, had been the chef and a business partner at Café Nicholson in Midtown Manhattan. That she did this as both an African-American and a woman in the 1950s, is nothing short of miraculous. But those stories were few and far between, not part of an overarching national phenomenon. And the lower kitchen ranks were more often than not populated with lost souls who lacked ambition, or the aptitude for a traditional career, weren't pursuing a love of food and or craft, or acting on martyr-like epiphanies, a version of which became a rite of passage for an entire generation. Professional cooking was viewed as menial, unskilled labor performed often in unsavory conditions by anonymous worker bees. The United States Department of Labor categorized chefs as domestics through 1976 when, after lobbying by the American Culinary Federation, who themselves required nudging by Louis F. Mary, the Hungarian-American Chicago chef writer, and television personality. It recognized them as professionals. Domestics suggests chauffeurs and housekeepers. Most Americans regarded cooks as something grittier. "I came from a nice family," says Mary Sue Milliken, who today co-owns Border Grill and other restaurants with business partner Susan Feniger. "My dad had a PhD, and my mom went to college, and my sisters both went to college. I think they looked at me like I had said, 'I'm going to go be an auto mechanic.' They thought, 'Oh, God.'" Cooking was not really considered a career, remembers Mario Batali, one of the most visible chefs in the United States today, who double majored in Spanish theater and business management at Rutgers University, before falling in love with Pro Kitchen at Stuff Your Face Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in 1978. "It was the first thing you did after you got out of the army, and the last thing before you went to jail. That was because anybody could get a job and put on a white apron and go peel potatoes and make soup and do the grunt work, because it was the lowest common denominator in the city. Not necessarily in the country, where you would have been forced into construction or farming. But if you lived in an urban area, you just got hired as a cook. You didn't have to train." One of the comparisons I make today that illustrates the difference between then and now is, back in the day, you never would put your uniform on or anything that made you look like a cook on the way to work, says San Francisco-based chef Jan Birnbaum, who started his career in New Orleans and New York. "Because it wasn't a proud thing to be. You're that guy behind the door who has no skill. He's certainly not intellectual, and he probably is either a criminal or he's amongst them. There's just a whole lot of undesirable stuff." Today, the streets of San Francisco, man, they proudly walk down the street all the time in full uniforms. Even in France, historically the Western capital of fine dining, this stigma attached to the profession through the 1960s. Chefs were not renowned or celebrated. At best, they were regarded as craftsmen. Alain Sayoc, who grew up in the mountain village of Millau, France, and would go on to become the chef of Le Cygne and Le Cirque in New York City, remembers the moment he first became enticed by the kitchen, in the mid-20th century. At age 14, at his brother's wedding, he struck up a conversation with the chef, which sparked an interest he couldn't shake. "Why do you want to be a cook?" demanded his father, who wanted his son to take up the family's glove manufacturing business. Sayoc persisted until his dad relented, walked him into the town's only one-star restaurant, where the chef was a World War I buddy. "Do you want to take my son?" asked the senior Sayoc. "He wants to be like you, a stupid chef." Even after he became a cook, Sayoc hid his profession from women. If they learned he worked in a restaurant, he told them he was a chef du rang, dining room captain, which was more prestigious. Consider, too, Auguste Escoffier, whose crowning achievement, Le Guide Culinaire, first published in 1903, was the kitchen Bible of its day. The book codified basic recipes and techniques, set forth a system for organizing the kitchen brigade, and recommended a front-of-house structure. Yet Nathan Myhrvold, author of a defining tome on modernist cuisine, unsentimentally dubs Escoffier the Henry Ford of the conventional kitchen. His masterwork was fundamentally motivated by gastronomy as a manufacturing process rather than as an art. He was an artisan striving to run a factory rather than be an artist. So what happened? To impose biblical simplicity on the narrative would be dishonest. There was no Garden of Eden, no aproned Adam and Eve from whom all future American chefs descended, no single moment that lit the fuse. The movement was scattershot but not coincidental, produced Big Bang style by a confluence of events and phenomena. The Vietnam War and the resistance at home, the counterculture, easy access to travel, the music, movies, and literature of the day, drugs including the pill, and a new approach to restaurant cooking, to name the factors most often cited by those who were there as the ones that propelled them into the kitchen. "It's a universal mind," says Thomas Keller, chef owner of a restaurant empire founded on Yountville, California's The French Laundry, of the national reach of those influences. We all talk about universal minds and how people come up with the same idea relatively around the same period of time without having had conversations about it personally. They're just doing the same thing. Jonathan Waxman, a California chef who has toggled back and forth between the coasts throughout his career, puts it slightly differently. We all had the same acid flashback at the same time, he says. But each of us did it differently. I was against the Vietnam War. I saw hypocrisy everywhere, racism everywhere. In New Jersey, there were race riots going on in Asbury Park. It was the next town over from where I grew up. Our high school was closed for racial tension when Martin Luther King got shot. I saw hypocrisy and injustice, and I didn't want to be a part of that world. I wanted an alternative existence. I was in the draft. It was something that you had to think about. You couldn't say, I'm against the war because war sucks. It was, I might have to go to the war. I had friends whose older brothers were killed in Vietnam. It wasn't the elephant in the room. It was the room that we grew up in. Jasper White, chef and restaurateur. Shots rang out over Kent State. 67 rounds over 13 seconds. The date was May 4, 1970. Within weeks, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were eulogizing the victims, student protesters slain by National Guardsmen, in song. Four dead in Ohio. Violence had erupted periodically, traumatically, throughout the prior decade. Thunderclaps in a slow-moving storm that felt like it might never end. Lee Harvey Oswald shot and killed President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963. Terminating the Camelot era. James Earl Ray assassinated Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4, 1968. Jordanian Saran Saran claimed Bobby Kennedy 2 months later on June 6, 1968 in the kitchen of Los Angeles's Ambassador Hotel. No leader was safe, least of all those who preached nonviolence and progressivism. Nor were casualties confined to the political class. In August 1969, followers of Charles Manson, known as his family, murdered actress Sharon Tate and four others in the hills of Benedict Canyon, thickening the air of mayhem. Other losses were self-generated, but no less searing. Jimi Hendrix, discovered unresponsive in a London apartment on September 18, 1970, and pronounced dead in a hospital later that day. Less than a month later, on October 4, Janis Joplin succumbed to an accidental heroin overdose at the Landmark Motor Hotel in Hollywood, California. Both were 27 years old. Just kids. The struggle for civil rights threaded through the decade. In 1961, the Freedom Riders, a student activist group comprising both African American and white members, protested segregation on buses and in waiting rooms throughout the South, requiring protection from law enforcement. On August 4, 1964, three civil rights workers who had been missing since June were found murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Later that month, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his rousing I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington. Malcolm X, leader of the Black Nationalist Movement, was shot and killed in New York City's Washington Heights neighborhood in February 1965. There were historic gains. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in July 1964 and followed it with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the appointment of the first African American to the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, in June 1967. But they came at a high cost in an undeclared second Civil War. At the University of California, Berkeley, a ban on on-campus politics of any kind triggered the free speech movement, which grew directly out of the civil rights movement. Students had protested racial discrimination in hiring practices throughout San Francisco, prompting complaints to the university, and a Berkeley professor was prevented from promoting CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, on campus. The movement peaked on December 2, 1964. More than 1,000 students occupied the university's student union building, Sproul Hall, and the movement's leader, Mario Savio, delivered what became known as his An End to History speech on the steps of the building. The time has come for us to put our bodies on the machine and stop it, he declared. 2 days later, close to 800 were arrested, the largest mass incarceration of students in U.S. history. In 1965, the United States began deploying troops to Vietnam, a conflict opposed by much of the nation. The resistance redoubled in 1969 when the draft was instituted, taking the form of two lotteries. The nightly news, at a time when it was confined to 30 minutes each evening, delivered reports of carnage to American homes. For young men, the existential dread of being called up washed over life itself, causing many to reflect on the conservative preordained career paths laid out for them by their parents. There was a disturbance in the force about the Vietnam War, and the uncertainty of, hey, you might be shipped out, and you can't count on tomorrow, says Chef Jimmy Schmidt, who came of age in Detroit, Michigan. I think that led to being more adventurous, a kind of anti-the-status-quo type situation. Let's go live it while you can live it. I was still around when they had the mandatory draft, and I had to go get my draft card. You didn't know whether you were going to get shipped out or not. I remember getting it going, I don't want to go into engineering. I want to do something with my life. That also, I think, led to people traveling and going to Chicago and watching some band like the Grateful Dead, Eric Clapton, all that kind of stuff. The Doors were out. The Rolling Stones played at the Illinois Assembly Hall. That kind of was big stuff going on that was pretty massive for a kid in a small town. That was the days of Easy Rider and that type of thing going on in the movie front. Music, which in the pre-internet age could be disseminated most quickly and democratically via the radio, left the deepest crater. From the songs of folk singers such as Joan Baez, to the transformation of the Beatles from besuited, mop-topped lads from Liverpool, to full-fledged renegades, along with a shift from I Want to Hold Your Hand in 1963 to Helter Skelter in 1968. Of course, there was also the Woodstock Music and Art Fair in 1969. Perhaps most influential was Bob Dylan, who turned folk music on its ear throughout the 1960s, channeling the very forces that crisscrossed the Republic. He probably single-handedly changed the world, says San Francisco chef Mark Franz, formerly of Stars, and today of Farallon and Waterbar. The way he wrote music, the way he wrote his songs, they dragged us forward and made us look at what was going on and made us conscious. And then drugs and all the things that came around because of that. It was, I think, a natural progression. Art, writing, cooking. It was a renaissance. I'll tell you another thing that played into it. A certain idea of women's lib. I know that's an old-fashioned term. It was a moment where there was the pill. So we were free. We were free from worrying about pregnancy. There was just a hunger to be independent, to be our own bosses, to just strike out in our own world. I thought that that was a huge part of it. I wanted to be free. It was the exact right moment that coincided with that. There was a huge counterculture movement going on. Berkeley, when I went there, was a battle zone. Students were completely up in arms over Cambodia. The culture changed. There was a huge liberalizing of culture, so that all the old forms were just blasted and turned upside down, and everyone was kind of reinventing themselves as a hippie, or they were going through those whole counterculture movements. And I think that in some way this thing became possible, of just laying out, starting from scratch, not knowing a thing, fulfilling yourself. I think all of that was part of it. The women's movement, the counterculture movement, the anti-war thing. The whole society changed.
Patricia Unterman, chef and writer. As the 70s settled in, mistrust of authority and the government swelled. At about 2 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, June 17, 1972, police in Washington, D.C. discovered 5 men rummaging around the Democratic National Committee offices on the 6th floor of a building in the Watergate complex. They turned out to have intelligence backgrounds and ties to the Nixon administration, and were attempting to bug the DNC mothership and photograph party files while they were at it. So began the slow drip that would claim the Nixon presidency in 1974. Other forms shattered their conventions, including comedy. Lenny Bruce was arrested repeatedly for testing obscenity laws. Norman Lear revolutionized the TV sitcom, thitherto populated by the domestic and the silly, with shows that reflected the current reality, such as All in the Family, which premiered in 1971, featuring socio-political duels between bigoted Archie Bunkers, Carol O'Connor, and son-in-law Mike Stivic, Rob Reiner. Saturday Night Live, which debuted in October 1975, began life as a truly subversive show that exploded the lie of television with commercial parodies that poked at the supposedly contented facade of American life. The fake ads often ended with the actors mocking the exaggerated laughter on which real commercials ended. And Weekend Update, a satirical newscast. A newfound interest in food and cooking was of a piece with these shifts. The frozen dinners, unironically known as TV dinners, and industrialized food meant to nourish young Americans was no longer adequate. Just as they sought authenticity from their leaders and the arts, they craved something real to please their palates and sustain their bodies. Ever since watching the Vietnam War on television in 69, and seeing the riot in Chicago's Grant Park, and the Democratic Convention, and then Watergate, and the continuation of the war, and the continuation of things like the Kent State disaster, those things made me feel that our country had taken an absolutely wrong turn. And I believe very much in the world that I grew up being taught about, in terms of America being a country about freedom and the ideals of democracy. And I felt like we were making serious criminal errors. And I was really disappointed by it. It was fractious. Many people in our community thought we should bomb the hell out of Vietnam and get it over with. And then there were people that thought, why are we over there? What are the real reasons that we're over there? I was on some of the campuses where there were very big demonstrations. I was in Carbondale, Illinois, shortly after Kent State. There was actually going to be a Woodstock-like celebration in May, 1 year after Woodstock. May 4 was Kent State, and the celebration was planned for, like, May 15. We already had our tickets. So when Kent State happened, the government was getting very nervous. A bunch of us still went down to Carbondale for this festival. They issued the National Guard in. 1,500 National Guard were ensconced on that campus. I was never militant at all. I was sitting in a trailer drinking some soft drink when suddenly stormtroopers burst through the door and arrested all of us in the trailer for trespassing. They had declared a curfew on the town for sundown. It was still dusk and I wasn't outside. Anyway, they mistook me for another guy that had been seen demolishing a phone booth. I knew the guy, and I did look a little like him. But there were moments like that that were personal. There were things like watching it on the news. There were things like hearing your next door neighbor was dead from Vietnam. And then there were things like, fucking arrest me and throw me in a jail that hasn't been used since the Civil War, and I want the fuck out of here. I've had it with this. I've just got to go someplace that there isn't this. Around April 1971, I hitchhiked to Champaign-Urbana, where some friends were having a party. I was just not in a good place in my head. I was just disturbed by the darkness of the political climate, the few opportunities I was having with anything. And suddenly the party was sort of breaking up, and I said, "Where's Steve?" That was the older brother to my best friend. They said, "He went down to Key West." I'm like, "Isn't that the last island down there?" And they're like, "Yeah, he's all the way down there." I said, "Jesus, that's incredible. I bet it's warm." There were two brothers that were at the party, and I said, "Anybody want to go to Key West?" And these two brothers said, "Yeah, we'll go." We left about an hour later. Drove 36 hours, Champaign-Urbana, down a little rickety highway to Key West. It was a few months before Jimmy Buffett got there, and a few months before Key West was beginning to become the party town that it became soon after. When we pulled into town, it was like 2 a.m. We woke up our friend, and he said, "Sure, camp out. You guys get the couch, and you can have a sleeping bag and sleep on the porch." And we camped out. And it was the next day I was falling in love, head over heels, with Key West. The smell of it. Flowers, the wooden homes, the rickety little streets, the little tiny cafes to go and get food I had never even seen before, Cuban sandwiches and café con leche, and Maduro's plantains, and picadillo.
the same things that are the hallmarks of Cuban food now. We were saturated in music, but it was mostly still playing LPs on turntables. The Allman Brothers, Derek and the Dominoes, Dave Mason, all that kind of music. We were deadheads. We loved music. We would have been musicians of some sort if we had the talent to have been them. We knew everybody that played in the bands. We studied the backs of album covers like they were religious texts. We just were all into it. We'd go fishing, we'd try and eat for free, and finally, we'd get jobs. Some were house painters, some were carpenters. I lived there for a month, and quite frankly, we just got wrecked every day and zoned out, flowered out, and then realized that it suddenly ended with a thud, and I had to go back to work, figure something out. Nobody was hiring me in Key West. It was still a pretty financially depressed town, I guess. So I went back to Illinois, got a job doing different things. Met a girl, got into a relationship, decided to take her to Key West. 72, we went down, stayed at a campground. She liked Key West, but not as much as me. We broke up, went back home. 73 rolls along, got a job in a diner. Saved up money for 9 months this time. We, Van Aken, childhood friend Wade Harris, and Rick Taylor, a friend from Haynesville, Illinois, got a driveway car from Chicago to Miami. Dealerships need cars moved from one city to another, and a cheap way to do it is to get somebody to just drive it there. We had a Lincoln Continental Mark IV. Here we are with hair down the middle of our back pulling into gas stations in Tennessee, and people looking at us like we were moving scads of marijuana or something to have a car like that, not realizing we didn't own the damn thing. I was down there a couple days, and one of the guys that I had lived with in Illinois that had come down 2 years before with me in that first trip, he had made it. He financially was doing okay. He got a job as a carpenter at his own place he was renting, and he told me about the possibility of this barbecue place to go get a job at. So I found this guy, this big gentleman named Bud, asked him if he was hiring, and he said, yeah. And he hired me on the spot. I said, I don't have any experience with barbecue. All I've done is flipped eggs. He said, that's okay, man. You're working the midnight shift. Everybody's going to be so fucked up by the time you get to them that they won't know what you're cooking. Okay, fine. Worked the midnight shift. Did that for about 3 weeks. And then I got enough money to send Janet a bus ticket to Key West. And when I got to Key West, I was in America, but I was also, like, in another country with another set of values that seemed so far removed. And it was peaceful. And it didn't matter that I had long hair. Even old people would say good morning to me. And it was welcoming. And it was a Pacific, mentally, spiritually kind of a place that I just felt like, okay, this makes sense again. I'm back in an America that I can relate to, even though it's so far away from my home. And it was like being welcomed to the bosom of something again. And I loved it. I was so happy. And my disappointment with the politics and the situation was softened, because I was somewhere else, and I didn't have to contend. And it was not long after that that Nixon was bounced out of office, and things kind of got a little bit back on their feet. Norman Van Aken, chef. For those who could afford it, international travel beckoned. Some needed a break from the turmoil. Some craved new experiences and perspective on the United States and themselves. An accidental byproduct was that exposure to European attitudes toward food proved transformative to many. We're the generation that traveled with backpacks, says Los Angeles chef Evan Kleiman, who today hosts the current events radio program Good Food. When you travel, you eat, and you're eating pre-industrialized food. In Europe during the 70s, there was no such thing as frozen food. There was no such thing as industrialized products. There weren't even supermarkets. So you were eating food that is akin to what people who grew up in America were eating pre-World War II. So you go there and you have this unbelievably pristine experience for very little money. There's so much that's evocative about it. And we're all young, so we're all either finding people to go out with. I'm using the words go out loosely. Everybody's hooking up, right? You're out there,
You're either traveling with a boyfriend or girlfriend, or you're single and you're meeting kids that are traveling from all over the world. And you're having this sort of seminal experience that's filled with sensuality. So you're experiencing your own sexuality. You're drinking wine. You're eating food that's two steps from the field in a totally joyous, non-puritanical, non-judgmental way. For a lot of us, it's the first time that we've ever experienced food in this context. When we came back, I went to my mother. I want to make the broccoli different, but I need fresh garlic. And she's like, fresh garlic? I have this garlic powder. And then what happens is slowly we start doing it. Overseas culinary epiphanies could be more or less divided into two categories. The first was everyday food as it was woven into daily life in France, Italy, and other popular European destinations of the time. The market culture that drove home cooking and unfussy, soulful bistro staples, all of which dovetailed perfectly with the hippie movement toward pure, real food in the United States. Much of the historical blood flows to Berkeley because of the confluence of factors there, but similar strains were present elsewhere. Among our friends who had nothing to do with the restaurant world, people were interested in cooking, says New York City chef Michael LaMonaco. And it wasn't just that they were going to recipe swaps. I think a lot of this dates back to the hippies of the 60s, communal living, and the back-to-the-land movement, the back-to-the-farm movement. This purity of the late 60s, the early 70s. You have to look at it through this prism. People were weaving. People were making things with their hands. Texture. Ceramics was huge. Pottery classes. We were living in Brooklyn at the time. Park Slope had a kind of a Greenwich Village vibe to it. It had ceramic shops, and small bakeries were making breads and cakes and brownies and things that were more natural, with natural ingredients. There was a lot of talk of naturalness in food. I think that rippled through the culture, and everybody was kind of interested in food. I think that the hippies had a lot to do with it, says former Stanford Court pastry chef Jim Dodge, who grew up in a family resort and hotel business in Vermont. They weren't the best cooks, but they were looking for pure, pure ingredients, organic ingredients, good quality. They wanted to know how things were grown. I remember going to the organic farm with my father every day to pick up select produce, and the pride that this young hippie family had. They had long beards and dressed extremely casual. They lived in a very modest house. There was a lot of focus on organic. I think the biggest thing was that they were making their own breads, which nobody did at that time. Just for themselves, although some of them would sell breads. In New Hampshire and especially Vermont, I think there were a lot of organic restaurants and cafes. They were opening organic food stores at that time, so they were bringing awareness to it. Bronx-born Barbara Lazaroff, who would go on to co-create Spago and other restaurants with future husband and business partner, chef Wolfgang Puck, attended New York University, starting in 1970. On Friday nights, she participated in informal dinner parties with friends. She describes one frequent host, a well-funded Saudi student named Nasser, who had the biggest apartment, mostly unfurnished, with pillows scattered about.
"We would put newspaper all over the floor. And every Friday it would be a different cuisine. That's the first time I tasted sashimi and sushi. One person was from Abu Dhabi. Another was from Saudi Arabia. Another from Japan, Argentina, Peru. One person was Bolivian. A number of Africans from countries I don't think exist anymore because I can't keep track of how many times they've changed. So it was absolutely everything I aspired to immerse myself in but couldn't afford to. Travel. I was traveling through the stories and the cuisine and the lives of these other people."
Wonderful as it sounds, writer L. John Harris cautions against idealizing the era. "I was in the art department at UC Berkeley," he remembers. "That's when food became almost like theatrical performance art. There's that whole side in the 70s of cooking with friends and making it visually beautiful. It was food experienced as a kind of ritual for artists to be interested in, but ingredients were kind of irrelevant. There was a side of food at the time that was performance, theatrical and visual,
in addition to taste. We were living in communes. We were cooking for each other. There was a gourmet club we went to that cooked out of Julia Child and all of that. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. It was a mission. I felt like we were discovering something. It was certainly important to us. This is very California, and it can sound very pretentious and very hippy-dippy. But our generation was about changing things, whether it was anti-war or whatever. Some people discovered that you can change things through food. You can create pleasure. You can create community through food. Food is community. This was the beginning of the breakdown of the American family. We were recreating the family. We were living in communes. We were disgusted with the American system. I marched against the war, of course. But I didn't think of food in that way at that time, and I don't think most people did. I think we ignore the fact sometimes that this discovery of good food was about pleasure. It wasn't about changing the system at that point. I think that came a little bit later. I think we had discovered a great source of delight and pleasure and sensual gratification in a very sterile corporate world. So we weren't on a political mission at that time, I don't think. History tends to compress reality into very simple sound bites. It was a vast period in the 70s where we were about food as pleasure, sensual awareness, and community. The new interest in food wasn't limited to the counterculture. A proliferation of hobbyist cooking schools and classes materialized to meet the moment. A 1971 New York Times article listed no fewer than 24 Gotham-based businesses proffering cooking classes. Everything from fantasy camp instruction by the likes of writer James Beard and Mexican cooking priestess Diana Kennedy, to crash courses in Chinese food, kosher buffet catering, and macrobiotic practices. In their newfound fascination with food and cooking, many Americans were guided by a small group of writers and television personalities. James Beard, a failed thespian and opera singer of Hitchcockian stature who had lived for a short time in Paris, turned his attention to food full-time by 1940 and became a prolific author, television personality, commercial pitchman, and networker. He loomed large, as did Julia Child, whose first book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, published in 1961, helped demystify the intimidating European cuisine to generations of home cooks. Child's first television show, The French Chef, debuted in 1963. Amping up the effort. There was also Englishman Graham Kerr, less well-remembered than the others, but notable for the humor and bonhomie on display on his show The Galloping Gourmet, 1969 to 1971, on which he took a thematic approach to cooking, combining travelogue footage, history, and instruction. Sipped wine on camera, often running into a frame with his drink nearly splashing out of the glass, appeared in a variety of costumes, from a tuxedo to a knight's armor, and charmed a live studio audience. Richard Olney, an American expat living in France, also developed a cult following for his books The French Menu Cookbook, 1970, and Simple French Food, 1974, notable for their masterfully written recipes, chock-full of information, opinion, and evocative detail. A similar fandom sprung up around Brit Elizabeth David for her books such as French Provincial Cooking, 1960. Craig Claiborne ushered in a golden age of newspaper food writing when he became the New York Times food editor in 1957. In the role, he introduced the paper's standard-setting restaurant review system. And food magazines such as Gourmet and Food and Wine were beginning to make their marks, although they wouldn't begin covering chefs until years later. I view the American food revolution as having started in France. One of the markers is August 1975. Paul Bocuse appears on the cover of Newsweek magazine. That was 1 month before I came to the Culinary Institute of America to be a student. And to have a chef be on the cover of Newsweek magazine back in the day when Newsweek and Time actually meant something, that was a big thing. I remember buying as many as I could buy. I could only afford probably four of them. And bringing them home because I wanted to have them and show my parents what it was to be a chef. Things were starting to change then, and young people like myself were saying, wow,
This isn't just a job. The French created an aspiration for us.
Tim Ryan, President, Culinary Institute of America. The other dominant genre of culinary experience available to Americans overseas during these years